Good evening, everyone. I think we'll start this session. It's been a long and interesting day, and we hope to wrap it up in an exciting way here. My name is Julia McKinsey. I direct international affairs for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And I'm a bit of an interloper here, which I'll explain. We're here to discuss the human right to science, and I will give an outline of what broadly we'll discuss today. I am really representing, I'm channeling a woman named Jessica Windham, who's about to have a baby, who leads this work for the AAAS and works with the panelists that you'll hear, the real experts that I'll pass it off to in a few moments. So we're going to talk about, I'm going to give a short history of AAAS's work in this space, both at the intersection of science and human rights and how that led into this work. Give a brief history on the right to science in a broader way. And then the panelists are really going to dive into the meat of the conversation, which is about working with the scientific community and a variety of stakeholders to define the right clearly, and then really getting into the weeds with our last panelists on actually implementing the right, both in policymaking and in litigation. So briefly, AAAS has been talked about at a couple of different junctures of the forum. We're a partner in this forum, and so I don't want to be too heavy-handed about this. We're based in Washington, D.C., but we're an international nonprofit working at the intersection of science and a lot of things, policymaking, education, human rights. We're usually most well-known among scientists as the publisher of the Science family of journals. But that publishing house is connected to a nonprofit that does a variety of work, programmatic work internationally and domestically, on programs that advance our very, very broad mission to advance science and serve society. One of those programs, which Jessica, who I mentioned, leads, who I'm channeling, it's called the Scientific Responsibility, Human Rights, and the Law Program. So I'll just mention that Margaret, one of our panelists, who I'll pass it off to soon, and Jessica, who I mentioned, about exactly a year ago, penned an editorial on the topic that we'll discuss today that appeared in Science Magazine, so I encourage everyone to take a look at that. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the history at AAAS that led to a board statement on this topic and predated this editorial as well. So, over the last three decades, AAAS has worked at this intersection of science and human rights. So they started by focusing on the rights of persecuted scientists around the world, and then began to pioneer applications of scientific methods and technologies in the documentation of human rights violations, starting with forensic anthropology to document the disappeared in Argentina, and more recently and currently, using geospatial technologies to monitor large-scale human rights violations. So at the same time that these programs were going on at AAAS, we were reflecting about how not only science can be a tool for human rights research and documentation, as I've described, but also in the conduct and application of science, there was a risk of human rights abuses. So this program that I'm representing here looks at that intersection in really broad terms. So the intersection of ethics, the social responsibility of scientists, and the right to science, all of which are very pertinent and have been discussed in many different forms over the past couple of days at this forum. So it's with that broad history specific to the AAAS that our board of directors in 2010, I believe, issued a statement recognizing that the right to science lies at the heart of AAAS's mission and at the social in the social responsibilities of scientists. And so they undertook to coordinate the AAAS Science and Human Rights Coalition in conceptualizing the right and integrating it into members' activities. And so we're, of course, not alone in this. So around 2007, UNESCO, also a partner organization to this forum, started also a consultative process with lawyers, academics, ethicists, human rights practitioners to launch this process of dialogue about the content of this right. What is the right? That is the question I came to the table several weeks ago when I was kind of getting up to speed on this topic that I asked. So We're talking about a right first recognized in 1948 in the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which talked about the right to share scientific advancement, share in scientific advancement and all of its benefits. So in 1966, the binding treaty, known as the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, expanded on that provision, and there was broad acceptance of it. So in UN Article 15 states, governments shall recognize the right of everyone to enjoy the benefits of scientific progress and its application, conserve, develop, and diffuse science, respect the freedom indispensable for scientific research, and recognize the benefits of international contacts and cooperation in science. So that was ratified, and with some noteworthy exceptions, my country of the United States is not a signatory to this, for instance. But the good news is 170 countries are, so they volunteered to be bound by this treaty. But the challenge in implementing the right has been a lack of agreement to its meeting. So hence, AAAS and others undertook to engage the scientific and engineering communities directly in defining this right. So that leads me to very happily introduce the experts who you'll hear from today. We'll hear from Margaret Vitullo, who's the Deputy Director of the American Sociological Association, and as I said, has been working with Jessica on this that culminated in that editorial and other items we'll hear about. Teresa Stopler, who's the Executive Director of the Inter-Academy Partnership for Policy and a Senior Program Officer at the U.S. National Academies of Sciences and a member of the Global Young Academy. And lastly, we'll get into the weeds of implementing the right with Marco Peruca, the International Coordinator of Science for Democracy, or the Luca Concioni Association. So I'll turn it over to Mark.
Thank you, Julia. Okay, so before we go forward to describe our work on trying to understand what it means to have a right to science, my colleagues and I would like to share two points of clarification. First, in using the term science, we refer to the pursuit and application of knowledge and understanding of the natural, social, engineering, and medical worlds following an iterative, systematic methodology based on evidence. In other words, we have a broad and inclusive definition of science. Second, in talking to scientists, we in no way want to suggest that scientists are the only important stakeholders in the right to science. UNESCO's 2009 Venice Statement called for participation of scientific and academic communities in defining the right to science. Likewise, the AAAS statement that Julia mentioned talks about the right to science as central to the work of the AAAS. And so they agreed to work on bringing scientists' voices to this question. So our focus on scientists, while it comes from that tradition and that call from the Venice Statement in 2007, we want to acknowledge the other stakeholders who also have much to say about this topic. For example, indigenous groups that hold traditional knowledge, citizens who support the production of science through their taxpayer dollars, or for rents, the consumers of scientific products. So we in no way want to dismiss or minimize those other voices, even as our current efforts are working on bringing the voices of scientists to this question. So we happen to have the great honor of speaking to you all as distinguished scientists. And so we would actually like to ask you to bring your voices to this conversation as well. We're going to be using something called Mentimeter to do this. So if you can pull out your laptop or your tablet or your phone, that is the, let me get that out of the way. That's the Wi-Fi network here at the Academy, if you haven't already signed on to it, and the password. And then once you're attached to the Wi-Fi, if you can go to www.menti.com and put in that number, 606747, then you'll be able to respond to our questions. Can I give you all a moment to do that? Okay. All right, now the URL and the code will be on every slide. So if you're good with the Wi-Fi, I'm gonna go ahead and move on, because we're gonna start right off with a question for you all. Prior to reading about it in the World Science Forum program, had you heard about the right to science? If you could respond. Let's see, okay. Well, six of you have responded. 67% of you said yes. Here we go, there's a seventh person. Oh, this is very interesting. Now we're getting to 50-50. All right, that's quite fascinating in itself. When we, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but when we did a questionnaire of people in National Academies of Science, we're right on right now, 56% of them had heard about the right to science and the rest had not. So, now we're back to 50-50. So at any rate, I think that what we can take away from this is that there are a great many people who care a lot about science. You all wouldn't be in this room if you didn't care deeply about science and yet don't know about the right to science. That's a fascinating finding in itself. Okay, I am going to move on. All right, so over the past 10 years, Jessica Windham and I have worked together along with some fantastic collaborators, including Teresa Stopler, who will be talking to you all in a little while, and we've had the good fortune of working with Marco in more in a parallel way, trying to bring the voices of scientists to this question about what does it mean to have a right to science. And I'm going to briefly talk to you about three of those projects. There are four listed here. One is a study where we used focus groups to ask scientists about the right to science. We then followed up with that, doing a global questionnaire. We also did an analysis of state reports to the UN, the periodic reports that they send in, about what they said about their efforts to apply the right to science, even though there's no general comment. The UN hasn't really said what it means, but we have this 160 nations that have ratified the treaty, so what are they saying? And then most recently this year, our study of the National Academies of Science. Okay, so through those four projects, we have contributed five sets of insights on the right to science. The first has to do with what the benefits of science are. Then we contributed a continuum, a conceptual framework for understanding what it might mean to have access to science and what the tools and mechanisms are for supporting that access. We've provided a global comparative perspective on this, and we've provided some practical insights from health practitioners. I'm going to walk you through those things now. First, what are the benefits of science? These results come primarily from the focus group data that we did in the United States. As I said, we did focus groups with 16 different disciplinary groups, including physicists and acousticians and civil engineers and health and biological, health sciences, biology, a huge array. And we asked each of these groups to tell us what do you see as the primary benefits of your discipline to society. And one of the things that we found absolutely fascinating is that even though we were asking many different disciplines, the most commonly mentioned benefit of science across them all was health, the ability to contribute to positive human health. So of course we were expecting that from the biological and health science professionals that we talked to. But when the civil engineers started talking to us about thermodynamic labels that would say whether a medicine had been stored outside the safe temperature range that would assure the effectiveness of that medicine, we were fascinated. And we saw that again and again. So the first benefit was health. The second was advancing knowledge. The third was responding to the needs of the environment. The fourth, education and training. The fifth, an empirical basis for laws, policies, and programs. I'm not going to go through and read the rest of them to you. But this, as I said, these findings are from the US-based focus groups. When we brought this to the global community of scientists through a questionnaire, there was a little bit of variation in different regions between which benefits showed up at the very top of the list, or in the top five. But across all the regions, health and advancing knowledge were in the top two, which we thought was quite fascinating. Okay, the second major contribution of this work was providing a conceptual framework for thinking about what it means to have a right to access science. Farida Shaheed, the special rapporteur in the field of cultural rights, wrote in a 2012 report that access to science should be to science as a whole, not to a particular scientific outcome or application. She specifically stated that people have a right to access scientific knowledge, information, and advances. And this is quite fascinating, that they should have the right not only to consume science, but also to be involved in the production of science. Finally, she suggested that the right to access science, that the nature of that access may be contextually dependent. The results from our focus groups study help draw out the specific meaning of what it might mean, represent to have access to science as a whole within a contextually dependent framework. In the continuum of access that you're looking at right now, on the left-hand side, you see the general public, right? And on the right-hand side are scientists. So as a member of the general public, if a member of the general public decides that they're very concerned about climate, and they become a climate activist, right? They may move from simply access to the applications of science, which come through in news about what the weather's doing, to access to scientific knowledge and information. They want access to be able to understand more about what scientists are actually saying about changing climate. Well, if they're really interested, they may want to go even farther, and they may want to be able to access the literature on climatology, to try and understand better and really dive into what the scientists are writing. They may even, if someone is really motivated and has gotten training, right, they may actually try to reanalyze data about this to better understand what is happening in this situation. So this person who started off as a member of the general public, maybe they get deeply involved, they're a climate activist, then they go to graduate school because they want to learn more, then they start looking at that data. They're moving along the continuum of access from left to right. As you move along that continuum, you have increasing levels of risk associated with having that level of access, and increasing levels of responsibility. And that's why the continuum is lighter on the left-hand side and becomes darker on the right-hand side. If you are a scientist yourself, like let's say you're a physicist, right? But now you need open heart surgery. When you're working in your area of the physical sciences, you're on the right-hand side of that continuum. But when you end up being taken to the hospital and needing surgery, you're going to move toward the left-hand side of that continuum. Where you are on the access on the continuum of access is going to be contextually dependent. One of the key findings from the respondents was that governments should not be responsible for deciding where someone lays on the continuum of access. Rather, people's interest, motivation, aptitude, education, and training should be the things that decide where they lay on that continuum. Okay. So we also identified the third major contribution was identifying essential tools or mechanisms for allowing the right to science to function in a society. And it depends on funding, education and training, and access to information and communication technologies. Okay. So from the global questionnaire, We were interested to see to what extent are the views of scientists, engineers, and health professionals similar or different based on discipline and region with regard to the benefits of the right and the government actions required to support the right. I've already talked to you about some of the variation we saw on the benefits to the right. So now I want to briefly talk about the things that the scientists said that was necessary for the government to actually support them in doing their work. The top five government actions that were named in our global study were to increase funding, that fits in with our essential tools and mechanisms that you all have already seen, provide adequate education to the general public, you saw that as well, promote a positive view of science and scientists among the public. That's a very interesting point for me to bring up as an American, where I would say that at this point our government is not promoting a positive view of science. Fake news is what our president has called many of our scientific findings. Ensuring open access to scientific information and promoting and protecting academic freedom were other key elements that came up in that. I will say on the open access and academic freedom that in our most recent study with national academies, we found some variation by regions on those last two. But the top three are pretty positive across all of them. Okay, so again, quickly about the global questionnaire. We did find that there was variation depending on whether scientists were working in industry or the commercial sector versus whether they were working in an academic setting. Those in commercial settings were much more interested in reforming intellectual property law and promoting technology transfer than scientists who were working in academia. We also found that scientists who were working in the global south were particularly interested in the government working to promote technology transfer. Okay, so the final of the five sort of general contributions that I wanted to tell you all about had to do with some of the findings that we saw when we started talking to health practitioners specifically about the right to science. We found that there was some, that the health practitioners talked to us about the value of using a human rights framework. They thought that using a human rights framework to talk about access to healthcare would help create a policy coherence. And they thought that if the government, and in cases where they had seen the government use a human rights framework, it had a positive domestic impact. But they also talked about the limitations of a human rights framework, particularly that sometimes the relationship between governments and human rights organizations are fractious, that there are some very complicated issues that arise when trade treaties actually conflict with human rights treaties. And of course, the lack of enforcement for human rights. They really saw an enormous need for us to be looking at the idea of a right to science in terms of taxpayers giving money to the government, which is then used to support basic discovery science, basic development science, which companies then buy the products of that, right? And then go off and develop products that they then make enormous amounts of money from, and the people who pay the tax money can't afford to get access to those products. And that was an issue that they talked about quite a bit as a challenge in this. Because I'm running out of time here, I want to keep on moving forward. I know I'm sharing a lot with you in a very short period of time. Marco is going to help a lot to make this make sense as he talks about it in more concrete terms. Okay. Over time, we've spent 10 years talking about what the right to science might be. The Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights at the UN has also engaged in a process of beginning to develop a general comment on the right. And our next question is really, all right, if we're beginning to get a sense of what the benefits of science are, why it's what the benefits of science and how that would play out, what it means to have a right to access science, how could we actually implement this? What would this look like if you tried to talk about the right to science in specific countries? And so we thought, you know, there's got to be an organizational center that understands what's happening in countries themselves and can think about the progressive realization of the right to science within specific national contexts. And who could that be? So on one hand, we're kind of trying to figure out how do we bring these disparate things together. On one hand, we've got science and all of the empirical perspectives for knowledge production, the ontological and epistemological view of science and how that works on one side. On the other side, we have human rights, which have really been promulgated and thought about in terms of international law, right, and activism. All right, so then we have the right to science, which is kind of smack in the middle of these two things. And how are we going to bring together the voices of the scientists and the voices of the human rights practitioners? Who could do that within a national context to actually bring them together? And as we thought about this and tried to think who would be a pivotal actor in a national context, we found ourselves wondering whether national academies could play that role, which is where the impetus for the fourth of those empirical projects that we engaged in. And I'm going to turn the floor over to my colleague, Teresa Stoppler, who will talk about our work and findings in this area.
Great, thank you so much. So, yes, so national academies, I think many of you know as we sit in one that these are merit-based organizations, typically independent from government. The model depends on the country. There's many size variations, resource variations. But here we focus primarily on academies of science. These may include the social sciences, sometimes the arts, engineering sections, but I just want you to know that there's a lot of variation captured in this. I also want you to know that we included national young academies, which if you don't know, this is part of a growing global movement. There's about 40, over 40 national young academies at this point in different countries. They're early to mid-career scholars who are competitively selected for excellent scholarship, but also a commitment to science-serving society, and they typically serve 4 to 5 year terms in these young academies. So they were also part of this work that we'll be talking about. And so as these independent merit-based organizations that work at the national level and have these young counterparts in some cases, could national academies be a place to look at the right to science? And so going back to the Mentimeter, we'd like to ask you what you think. So could national academies, either senior or young, help in the fulfillment of the right to science? What do you think? And so if you still have your phone or your laptop open, you can just see the new one on your screen. I'll give you a second. Not really sure. Maybe you want me to tell you. You might know what I want you to say at this point. Okay, so many of you say yes, maybe not sure. So then moving on, do you think that working on fulfillment of the right to science could actually benefit academies? This is a different question. Okay, great. Again, many of you say yes. So I'm going to show you what we actually found in this questionnaire that we sent out to 172 academies, so 128 senior academies and 44 young. We had quite a high response rate, actually, overall 53%, which is great. And then complementing these this short questionnaire of closed questions, we also had interviews that we did following up with 14 academies, 10 senior and 4 young. And so I'm going to be telling you about three primary findings from this questionnaire. And this was done, I should say, with only those countries that had ratified Article 15 of the International Covenant. So we did not include, for example, the United States, which has a large academy that I work for, but unfortunately the United States has not ratified, so they were not included. So I just want to make that point. So first, and I need to explain this, but the right to science is both little known and perceived by many as core to the academy's mission. So I think this is a very interesting finding. So we found that 56% of survey respondents had not heard of the right to science prior to receiving the questionnaire. But at that same time, it was an idea that intrinsically resonated with the participants. So even though they hadn't heard of this formal right to science, as soon as we sort of explained what it was, they really seemed to immediately grasp the concept and think that it was something that definitely their academy would be central to fulfilling. And so I think this is a really compelling idea. So here's an excerpt from one of our interviews. This is a quote from an interviewer of what a participant stated. So she indicated that she has thought about scientific advancement almost as a privilege, but would like to learn about the notion of science as a right. She mentioned that there is something powerful about this idea. Okay, and then second, government relations is a key concern. So we know that one of the main goals of national academies is to provide independent, high-quality, authoritative advice to their governments, particularly their national governments in many cases. However, we know that that's not always easy to do, right? Even for academies. So even though a relationship with the government was very important, so 95% of academies said that yes, informing policy at the national level falls within the mission of the academy, which is good. I think it should say 100%, but 95% is great. Despite this agreement on the desire or the mission to inform policy at the national level, there were in the interviews indications that this has not always been easy and that sometimes this doesn't always happen, right? So for example, another quote, the academy was established within the past 15 years. They are not funded by the government. It has been quite an uphill battle to get to the government. So many academies are quite new. They struggle from some of the same challenges, funding, capacity. Sometimes they don't have staff. They're completely volunteer-based. And so actually making those linkages with the government can be quite challenging. And for the young academies in particular, most of them were only formed within the past decade. And so forming these relationships actually takes time. And so this is something at play here. And then another quote, the main issue is that scientists and politicians speak different languages, making it difficult to understand each other. This is a major problem worldwide. And I think this is something we've been discussing over the past few days, and we know that this is a challenge. If government relations are a key concern, these linkages with government are identified as central to the academy's mission, in these countries that have ratified this treaty or this international covenant, they're required to report on their progress on this. And if the academies can help them do that, right? Like, this is a new area of research. No one really knows what it means exactly or how to do it. Could academies be the group that could help them do that? And in so doing, by helping fulfill the right to science and help governments report on progress on it, could that help the academy's relationship with the government in some way? I don't know. We'd like your thoughts on that as well. And then the third finding is that partners and collaboration are essential. So throughout our interviews, there was a general theme that partnership was very important. So academies were generally more successful when they worked with other academies or other partners in this science policy landscape. So anytime we do something great, it is because we've engaged with others, one academy representative stated. It's best for the impact of the work to not do it by yourself as one academy, but to do it as a group of academies. And this is particularly interesting to me, being a member or being part of the secretariat for the Inter-Academy Partnership, a group of over 140 national academies, including the Global Young Academy. So if we work best in groupings of academies, that's interesting to us as a network to think about. One other thing is that we had looked across at the different topics that academies are generally working on, and we broke it down by region in terms of how they would rank their top activities. And one pattern you can see is that science education, the large green box at the top, and sustainable development are two themes that kind of cut across all of the regions of the academy. So Africa, Americas, Asia Pacific, Europe, Middle East, and North Africa. And so when talking about the right to science, if these topic areas are resonating or are of importance to academies across the regions, these might be good entry points to approach the right to science. So what are the next steps? So we did this questionnaire. It seems like there is interest in this topic, even though it was little known. It kind of really resonates with the academies and their mission. So how can we take this forward? So we had some preliminary thoughts on that. One is to train relevant academy staff in the right to science and opportunities for engagement. So during our interviews, many people indicated that they weren't very familiar, but they would really welcome resources to train staff and to learn more about what this means and to help them and their academies think about what that might mean for their academy. We can identify academies in countries soon to report to the UN Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Again, helping the academy help their governments meet this requirement to report and have something positive to say about it, right? And then invite partnerships to facilitate academy participation in the UN reporting process, since we know that collaboration is identified as really a key element to our successful endeavors. And then support preparation of a report or contribution of academy to government's UN report. And so now I want to ask you, do you think it would be a good thing if your organization was more engaged in the fulfillment of the right to science? And we brought in this to organization rather than academy, just so you can think about it in your own context here. You can say no if you think.
They're anonymous.
It's anonymous. Okay. Good job. Okay. Honesty. This is good. Okay. Great. And so now, if you could humor me at 5:45 on a Friday afternoon after a three-day conference, we're going to interact with each other and discuss something quickly. But what do you think you could do personally, however small, to help fulfill the right to science within your own organization? So what I'd like you to do is just think about that very briefly, maybe write a note if you want, and then just pair up with someone close by you, discuss it. And then we can enter those results through the Mentimeter. So right now, if you could just quietly think, and then I'll prompt you to discuss with your neighbor briefly. Okay, yeah, and if you haven't already, go ahead and pair up just for, we'll just be real quick on this. Okay, and you can go ahead and start entering any good ideas you've come up with about what you could individually do within your organization. And then if you could just wrap up your conversations in about 30 seconds, because I want to make sure we leave enough time for, so sorry to rush you. So we have continue discussing what the right to science is about and how to promote it and protect it, volunteer on activities that promote the right to science. Sorry. Still have good ideas. Can you enter them and can you enter them in the little text box? Access to information, science hours allow for employees to prepare concepts, presentations, and share them with other peers. Awareness and push for open access publications. Yeah. Anything else very quickly before we move on? I just wanted to get you thinking, make resources available. Okay. So here are some ideas of what we think you can do. So AAAS actually has a science and human rights report. We recommend that you sign up for that on their website. You can share yours or other science and human rights resources with colleagues, and we've been trying to think about how to bring this together, for example, for the academies who requested resources on this. Build relationships with vulnerable and marginalized local communities. Assess how effectively you integrate human rights into your or your institution's work. Organize a discussion group in your institution to connect these ideas. Integrate human rights principles and approaches into training and standards for scientists. So I think scientists often don't receive this type of training. It would be interesting to incorporate this. Teach the value of scientific methods and tools for human rights to science majors. teach through experiential learning effective methods for collaboration. And so these are some ideas that we thought about, and we will capture yours as well. So thanks for participating there. And then I'll just hand over quickly for the acknowledgments and to pass over to the final speaker.
Very, very quickly, because we want to make sure we leave time for Marco and conversation. These are just all of the people who've collaborated with us on this project. First and foremost, Jessica Windham, since she's not here. I also wanted to point out, there's the website about the Article 15 work. If you look up AAAS, if you Google AAAS and Article 15, you'll easily find this information. But there's lots here. There are reports on the work that we've described, as well as a variety of other resources. Thank you so much for your time. If you have any questions, please feel free to contact me or Teresa about this. And with that, I will turn it over. Oops, I will try. How do I turn this off? Just one more moment. I don't know how to get out of this. Okay. Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I have no slides and no the wonderful multimeter because I belong to one of the categories that have been highlighted twice already today that range at the very bottom of the list of appreciation or trust. I'm a former member of parliament, so I'm coming out of the closet at the beginning. There's always exception to the rule, so perhaps I could be one of those. Before entering into what my organization does, I'd like to go back to the entire UN mechanism, because it's not necessarily a given that people know what we're talking about when we're talking about the UN. So the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights was drafted in 1956. So you can't imagine what the world was like in 1956. Actually, in this very country, they had tanks in the streets to repress a revolt from students. It was adopted in 1966 and opened for signatories and entered into force in 1976. So 56, 66, 76. You can imagine what the world was like in 56, 66, 76. At least they all agreed on something, on a variety of things, not only they agreed on a covenant on economic, social, and cultural rights, but also on rights pertaining to the political and civil parts of our public and private sphere. But they agreed on a variety of things. One of the three, at least, of those things are included in Article 15 of this covenant, and they are the freedom necessary to do research, the right to share the knowledge that comes out of that research, and thirdly, and most importantly perhaps, the right to benefit from the development of science. So these are the components of the right of, as Michael Mansisidor, which is one of the coordinators of this group of experts, is calling it, right of science is the right, the freedom necessary to carry out research, and the right to science is to share knowledge and benefit from the latest developments. So if the world agreed on these three elements during the Cold War, actually not so cold, but certainly during the war, today, where we are richer and freer and happier to a certain extent, I think we should also find ways to promote and protect those three rights. The United Nations has set up a committee which is made of experts. They're not necessarily scientists, but they are nominated by governments. There are 13 in their own personal capacities. And every 4 years, they monitor the ways in which countries that have ratified the covenant implement the rights contained in those documents. These reports are called country report and are submitted to the committee. 4 years ago, when we started to work a little closer with the AAAS, and when I say we, it was called at that time Luca Coscioni Association, because nobody can pronounce it. Now we are called Science for Democracy, which makes things easier and tries to amplify the link between science and decision making. One of our members who teaches international law at the Loyola Law School in Los Angeles went before the committee and said, look guys, not a single country since 1976 has made a paragraph about the way in which they implement Article 15. How's that possible? And it said, you know what, you're right. And so they asked him, how do you think we should ask these countries questions about the way in which they are or they're not implementing Article 15? And so a debate came out, and a set of recommendations was circulated, and in October last year, an open dialogue was convened with members from the academia from all over the world, unfortunately mainly from Europe and North America, but still. I mean, they opened up this debate to people that were coming from different backgrounds and also perspectives to try and gather together as many information as possible to prepare what Margaret said, a general comment. A general comment is a document that will try to explain what in fact it is meant by the 4 points of Article 15 and the 3 subparagraph of 15.1. The general comment was supposed to be issued a year ago, then was supposed to be issued 6 months ago, then perhaps it's going to be issued in March, and maybe it's going to be issued in June. The problem is that behind those discussions, there's always a background. If we could, have a look at the map of the countries that have not ratified the International Covenant, taking the US aside because they don't ratify anything, but still they have signed it, you will see that there's a big gray area, unfortunately, in the Arab world, meaning the Arab Peninsula. But if there is a member coming from the Arab Peninsula, member of the EU committee, or close to this country, he or she will block anything that in a way can be considered to be sensitive to the countries that have nominated him or her. So, despite the fact that we're talking about rights, and there's ample evidence and history of how these documents have been written and how some countries are applying them, it is all a political slash diplomatic game, and this is why the general comment hasn't been adopted yet. It is a very, we've seen drafts that we cannot share with the public, and there's the traditional knowledge, citizen science, there's everything is in there. Perhaps it's a little less radical in the nice meaning of the world as we would like it to be, but it's there, and it's going to be useful to draft guidelines for member states on how to report on the ways in which they actually implement Article 15. Now, the covenant also has an optional protocol, which sets up a quasi-judicial body to which individuals or organizations can bring complaints whenever they believe that one of the rights included in the covenant has been violated or not respected by the country. Now, this international mechanism are used when your national remedies haven't given you a positive answer or an answer that you think was in line with the international rule of law. There's an interesting clause in this optional protocol that says that the due process, in a way, so if your country doesn't reply within 12 months, you can skip the national level and go directly to this committee. Of the 167 countries that have ratified the covenant, only 23 have ratified the optional protocol. They are mainly, again, in Europe and Latin America, but still, it's a start. And the thing that it's a start, it's something that we always have to keep in mind when we talk about the right to science. Today we are in a panel discussion with some 25 people in the audience. I hope that the next forum will start with the right to science. Because science, ethic, and responsibility are fine for those that work within science, but science has a huge impact on our daily lives. I was joking before, at lunch when we were talking about post-truth or fake news. I come from a country that has a big tradition of science and has a big tradition of religion. Every TV dedicates at least 10 minutes a day to the horoscope. Every Sunday, it dedicates it to another guy dressed in white. So if you grow up or for some 70 years or 60 years since we got TV. And every day you're bombarded by a guy dressed in white that says certain things. And at the end of the guy that says certain things, you have the stars that tell you what's going to happen to you. I mean, today's fake news are nothing compared to those, because we grew up with them. They are part of our culture. There's no way you can talk about post-truth today, because what was yesterday's truth? Was again the faker than today's, in a way, because at least we have debunking that can be done. In those days, you only have one TV channel, black and white, all day long saying the same thing. And then at the end saying the opposite, but nobody was saying that this metaphysics or this legend clash with each other and have nothing to do with reality. So please, when you go back home, keep in mind that there's no such thing as post-truth, because there was no truth, and certainly there's no such thing as fake news, because there's always been fake news. Going back to where we started, it's also very important to understand what we mean by Academy of Sciences. I don't know if any Italian Academy of Sciences is involved here. Our National Academy of Sciences is called Academy XL. And one would say, because it's extra large. No, because it's a Roman numbers of 40. Because it's made of 40 people, which average age is 75. They're all men. So again, we have to understand who we are talking to or we are trying to involve in this kind of exercise, because it can be part and parcel of the regime, which is the one which is the product of the fake news and the pre-truth. And it's good to invite them and involve them. We have tried to have a debate at the Academy of Lincei, which is not the National Academy, but which is where, if you are a very well-established scientist, you go and organize your debates. But then in the audience, you have your peers. You don't have the general public. So we have to try and make this become a political, if this adjective still has some positive meaning, issue. That is, that we have to talk to the polis, to the city, to the citizens, because it concerns them more than any other human rights. Going back to the United Nations allow non-governmental organizations, civil society organizations, also, of course, Academy of Sciences, any individual to attend these meetings. And if they have extra time, they allow you to raise your hand and ask a question. So instead of raising hands and asking questions, at the website that's called freedomofresearch.org, we have started to collect, using publicly available information, shadow reports on the way in which member states inform the UN Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights on how they implement the entire covenant, but in particular Article 15. And over the last 10 years, we have sent 7 reports. It's not easy to compile those documents, because you have to go through all the national legislation concerning a few specific issues. We are concentrating on 4 issues. One is reproductive rights, it has abortion in particular. The other one is end-of-life decision, because it has a lot to do with science. Nobody ever thinks about the fact that until 50 years ago, maybe 40 years ago, there was no thing as life support. So technology has changed the way in which we consider our life. The other issues that we are now studying are research on embryonic stem cells and also genome editing on plants and humans. It's difficult, again, to find laws. Sometimes they don't have laws. Within the European Union, we have European directives, but then again, you have to understand how countries implement the European directive into national legislation. So, and we have highlighted a few things, and the recommendations that have come out of the scrutiny that the committee has done have been sent back to the countries to try and alert some of the pieces of legislation that were not necessarily or perfectly in line with the norms of the covenant. One would say this is the usual exercise that the rich people do to pick on the poor in the north versus the south. Could be the case, it's not the case. 2 of the worst performing countries when it comes to embryonic stem cell research are Germany and Italy in the world, despite the fact that in particular Germany invests quite a lot of money in research. Italy is doing way worse than Germany. And so not only we highlighted that in general terms, but we tried to bring a we brought a case before the committee using the fact that Italy has ratified the optional protocol. So in a way, we have this additional quasi-judicial body that can be interested with some violations of human rights. If they said that on the one hand we were right, more quoting Article 12 that has to do with reproductive health rights, they said that we have no notion of what you mean or we should mean with the rights to science, because the problem that we have in our national legislation is that you can produce up to 3 embryos that can be implanted in a woman. Those that are not used have to be frozen and cannot be given to national research institute or exported to other non-national research institute. We said, okay, even if you're obliging someone to implement an embryo, and up to 5 years ago, there was no way you could do a prenatal screening. So the other solution would have been an abortion, even in a country where abortion is still not necessarily the law of the land. The other problem that we highlighted is that the law is blocking the right of science. That is, Italian scientists to carry out research on embryonic stem cell have to buy material from abroad and cannot use the made in Italy stuff. And we go around the world saying made in Italy is better than anything else. So they said, unfortunately, not only there's no precedent, but also it's not clear to the UN itself what this right of science should be. And so everybody who is doing the work that we are doing, and we were saying before that perhaps AAAS should become AAAS because the advocacy part of the work is necessary here. What we are doing today will actually be empowered even more the day in which this general comment will be adopted, because there we will have additional elements that can be used to go before the committee, but also to go before a national courts or constitutional courts that are one of the other parts of the system that in fact need to be used. The last example that I wanted to make is concerning other types of research, because we're always talking about health, and we were saying before medicine is also on the top of the chart where of the type of sciences that trust us the most. The other one is genome editing on plants, which brings yet another player in the discussion. Not only is science involved and therefore scientists and therefore universities or academies of scientists, not only politicians, the decision makers, the legislators, the governments, it's also judges, people that work in tribunals and courts. They have also been included in this discussion. The European Court of Justice adopted the sentence in July 2018 on mutagenesis, saying that the technique called CRISPR, which was invented in 2012, should be treated as if it were genetically modified organisms. Europe adopted a directive in 2001/18, this is the number of the directive, that regulates GMOs in a very strict way. So it takes a lot of time and effort and resources, not only to study, but also to introduce in the market the products. The question here, I mean, you don't have to be a scientist, or rocket scientist, as we say, to understand that there's a problem in regulating something invented in 2012 with norms adopted in 2001. Simply because at that time, the debate on genome editing was in very, very small circles in like 3 places of the world. And of course, not because it's old, but because it's bad. It's not equipped to regulate what has come afterwards. This, in a way, and we're working with 120 research institutes around Europe, and we are going to have a meeting in mid-December and possibly again another one at the European Parliament next spring, is one of the elements and arguments we're trying to use to go to a supranational body, because a decision taken by the European Court of Justice cannot be appealed, and say, look, here we have a problem. We as the global community, have the right to benefit from the latest discovery of science. Within Europe itself, genome editing on plants has gone forward. We organized a prohibited snack in front of the European Parliament in March, where we ate CRISPR rice in front of a square full of students coming from the Biotechnology Institute in Ghent. Everybody ate it. At the very end, the police came and confiscated the rice, which is something that we asked them to do because we wanted to go through the entire analysis of the rice and tell us if it was or it wasn't CRISPR. They took everything. We've been interrogated for 3 hours with my colleague. At the end, they issued a document in which they said the rice was not enough to carry out research. We need at least 0.5 kilo, which is 1/4 pound of rice, to finally understand what was inside the rice and if the rice had been genetically modified. I mean, everybody knows that you need like 2 or 3 things. I mean, a handful would be more than enough to do all these things. And they had a handful of rice. So they didn't dare challenging what we said and what we did along the lines of the reasons why we did it, because they knew that there was a legal problem that could have created a continental problem in terms of a decision taken by a court. So, but it went viral all over the internet. We did it again in Bari, in the southeast, where there's where a lot of rice is grown in Italy. The rice is coming from a lab at the University of Milan. So if science is going on and you're blocking it because of we don't know why, because there was no scientific document attached to the decision, actually, the European Science Advisory Mechanism that was quoted in a panel this morning issued a document 3 months after the decision of the court. So what is the point in having a scientific advisory mechanism that tells you that they were wrong when they had already taken a decision? There's no reason. So we have to review the entire thing, and this is why making the right of and to science a central component of people that talk about science, how you want to communicate it, involve with people, and have informed and evidence-based decision, and before decisions also. Debates is central. One last thing about the fake news, and again, another thing that raw data is also very important. I come in from Africa, where last week in Nairobi, UNFPA, which is the agency that talks about population, has convened an international conference that, of course, was boycotted by the Trump administration, so the usual stuff when it comes to international fora. They told us, without no shame, that the census data that they are using to develop models and to trying to map where people live, what they do, and what's their access to essential health services dates back, in the example of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 1985. Since 1985, how many wars have happened in the Democratic Republic of the Congo? At least 3. 2 of them killed 2 million people. At the same time, we know that that country has one of the highest fertility rate in the world. So we don't know what we're talking about if we don't talk about this stuff, which is sharing, in this case, scientific knowledge. The United Nations compile every year a world report on drugs, because last year, for the first time in 25 years, India sent some information. We realized that there was a booming in cannabis consumption in the world, because India just sent data to the UN. And they say it candidly in the preface of the executive summary. So this is why it's crucial to consider this stuff a human right, because if we don't take that into consideration, it's a violation of the way in which we should stay together, which is based on rights. There was another example of this fake news, but I'll leave it at that, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Fascinating conversation. I have a series of questions, but because we have only 15 minutes, I wonder if I should first open it up
to the floor. If anyone has a question, let's see, let me rush here, please. Just wave your hand. Please.
Hello, my name is April Tash. I'm coming from UNESCO. I wanted to mention that in the context that we're speaking of the right to science, which is a very difficult area, the states do meet and have strange discussions. They don't seem to know where they're going with it, and there are many elements that have come up. As you mentioned, there are the three that come from the International Covenant. But there was some work done in the last 10 years. About 4 years of work was done to create a recommendation at UNESCO, which is based on the Declaration of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, rather than the Covenant, because the Universal Declaration is the international instrument which is universal. So the Covenant, which isn't yet, although it should be in universal, isn't yet. And that original source of the right to science is also available as a legal source. That provides a legal source for a document which then gave operational guidelines. These are the common standards that should be implemented and that will have a four-yearly monitoring process separate from the Human Rights Council. And that starts in 2021 with the first reports. We're now designing the indicators for it. I just give the comment because it's an additional information for the right to science. The right to science, as it's embedded in this by the agreement of the countries, 195 countries agreed to it without abstention, and they asked for it to be embedded in this, and so it's entirely a human rights document we're talking about. But whether or not they will start to consider whether the right to science is available to individuals and implement this document, we cannot be sure until maybe 10, 20 years from now.
Yeah, well, thank you, because I said that I was a politician, so you don't have to trust what I say. I mean, I have also a very bad memory. I was supposed to say that also the central part of the right to science, which is the sharing of knowledge, thanks to UNESCO, has now become a long set of recommendations on open access to science, which is something crucial also for the developing world, not only because of what we also heard before, having access to literature, but also publishing and being considered and known at the same time on the other side of the world. But the recommendations and also the preambular part of that long document is wonderful. And finally, we see in words what activists like us or advocates have been saying for a few years. So we have to congratulate UNESCO, I would say, for once. But that's, I mean, I didn't say that.
Touched on the number of stakeholders involved in this very, very broad area. I wonder if you can comment on where are divisions between some of those stakeholders the largest, and what's being done about it?
That's a really important question. I wonder whether you have a better sense of that because of your work in international legal contexts.
I remember when you presented your study with the survey at the, we were together in Geneva February 2017, I was struck by the fact that the question, well, the answers coming from the North or of people coming from developing countries but studying and working in universities in the United States and Europe has nothing to do with the lack of freedom to carry out research. And still, to this day, if you go to a university talking about some things, they never consider this as a problem for them. While I co-authored a collection of essays last year that's called, it's in Italian Latin, which is called Proibisco Ergo Sum, I prohibit, therefore I am, that's trying to highlight how still the problem is in the law. And people that are victim of those violations or restrictions do not recognize that the problem is in the law. And in some fields, UK and US have way more freedom than other countries when they carry out research. We don't know what's happening in China. Perhaps we don't want to know what's happening in China. But I was struck by this fact. So I would say that also involving scientists in the quest for freedom, the right to science is the brother, sister. People say it's a sleeping beauty of human rights. Okay, so it's time to wake her up or wake him up. But it's the cousin, twin cousin of freedom of speech, because without the freedom to carry out research, you will never be able to falsify what has been given as the official version of that specific research. We were told before that women were considered not capable of doing or studying for 150 years ago, or 100 years ago. To this day, in some countries, they cannot, for cultural / metaphysical reasons, perhaps. But still, the lack of having included in their daily work the possibility that some things cannot be done because there's not enough or the necessary freedom, I think it's a problem. So I would say that not only scientists should try and become as advocates as possible of their causes, but they also will have to understand if, among all the problems that they encounter daily, the lack of freedom to carry out research, or that is the right of science, is the biggest problem. Then there's a big difference between science in rich countries and science in developing countries. I was in Africa before going to Kenya. We had a seminar organized at the Addis Ababa University. And there again, you have a completely different take on a variety of things. But the moment in which you address science as a human right, because the developing world has been more attuned to the if you want, the rhetoric or the propaganda of human rights or human rights violation, in a way, it's easier to try and come faster to the conclusion that, in fact, it's a violation of human rights.
I think I'd want to follow up on that by maybe flipping your question a little bit. Because one of the things that is really tricky right now, as we are trying to understand what it means to have a human right to science, is that there's a great deal that we don't know and that hasn't been applied. So in some ways, the question that we really have to figure out is where can we find common ground? So, for example, in the National Academies data, where we found that looking at sustainable development was an area that there was a great deal of agreement, that people were interested in thinking about that as a common application of the right to science, that I think that's where we'll start getting some purchase, is because we're going to have some more applications of this right in law, in the courts, where people can agree on it. And then we can start looking for the places where they disagree. But the real meat, the juice is going to come where we figure out what can we agree on it about in this regard.
So I'm from Poland, and I represent also the Marie Curie Alumni Association. So as a researcher and a woman, to answer your question, to me the most intuitive division is religion versus science. And I have a feeling that intuitively, or maybe historically, it's considered that the right to religion would be closer to human rights than the right to science. And how is then that considered as a, like, is there a way to shift maybe or equalize priorities there?
Do you want to start?
My political party was called Radical Party. It was founded in Italy in 1870. If you look at the platform of the first participation in the United Kingdom of Italy elections, it's still valid to this day. Point number one was separation between church and state. So I agree with you, and the problem is that the other part of the constituency that needs to be involved is politicians, of course, not only scientists. They have to realize that if we're here, it's not because we were created, it's because of science, because it allowed us to remain where we are and live in the way in which we live today. Now, if you go, if this were a campaign trail, people would start booing or cheering. Perhaps nobody would ask you a question or to repeat what you just said, because conventional wisdom is that you don't have to touch these kind of issues. The one of the adjectives, first adjectives used by the Radical Party of the 1870s was to be anti-clerical, which is not anti-religious. You have to keep these things separate. On the one hand is the right to profess, believe, and doesn't have to be a religion, I would say. It can be also a cult of anything, or a soccer team, or a rock and roll band. But at the same time, when it becomes part of the institution, there you have a problem, because your worldview should not limit or be imposed on mine. While the metaphysical stuff tends to do that, the scientific stuff doesn't.
Yeah, I think we get, as we start thinking about human rights, I mean, you have freedom to and you have freedom from. And this question about science is if we start thinking about freedom from, that you have freedom, your right to religion also includes your right to be free from, should you so choose. So they're not necessarily contradictory, although for one person, they may choose to enact those rights in very different ways.
One other thing is, nobody wants to make science the new religion, of course. So this is something that has to be spelled out. I mean, not here, but if you go around the world, you're not saying that a law that doesn't respect science 100% should be unconstitutional. I would say it should be, but this is not the way in which you are want to promote the right to science. It is, there shouldn't be limitation to worship, but there shouldn't be limitation to research. Then the result, I mean, we know what it is. Everybody uses a GMO every day because it's a medicine. The prosciutto di Parma or Parmigiano Reggiano are produced by pigs and cows that eat tons of GMOs imported from Spain. But it's organic and made in Italy, where there's no way you can grow GMOs. So you have to really go to the hard facts, use some time to try and explain them, and then people will take a decision. I'm sure an informed decision, it's usually conducive to the best possible outcome.
Can I actually ask a question?
Oh, well, I was just gonna ask one of you, because I wanna do a good job. Yeah.
Okay, for my colleagues here. So is there or should there be a limit to the right to science? So for example, human gene editing has come up recently. In cases like these, would there ever be a danger or a risk that the right to science could be used to perhaps justify or protect things that we might not want to happen in research?
I think it was a quote before saying, one thing is to have the right to do something, one thing is to do the right thing. So I would say you should have the right to do whatever you want, as long as then it's the right thing to do. So there were discussions at the beginning of the genome editing craze to impose a moratorium. A moratorium would be possible if all those doing research would agree, because we know that there's nothing that is 100% in nature, so there's always a bad guy or a good guy that will continue to do it. In this world and in the world where you don't have access to information, if people are doing or not doing that, I would say that research should be, of course, not allowed on humans unless they really want to, because at the end of the day, if you know that you're gonna die anyway and you want to give your body to research, there should be a way for you to do that. But then applying the product of the research is a different story.
Okay, final question.
Thank you. Because this is the final question, so I'm sorry, I'm just going to be a little blunt and ask, what is stopping the IAP, the AAAS, and other organizations that are part of the science network of coming up with a framework to assess countries' performance on the right to science? I come from a country which ratified the convention 11 years ago, has not submitted a single report on compliance. I'm pretty sure that none of the science advocates in my country even know about the ratification of this convention in itself. While we talk about other rights that we have signed up for within the UN system, but the right to science never comes up. So if AAAS or IEP would issue a, let's say, an annual report like the Human Rights Council does, you know, these are the countries that haven't done X, instead of waiting for the bureaucratic version of a rules for business on how to operationalize the...
I'd like to start off on a response to that, but I think my colleagues may each have something to add to it. I'm very interested in the fact that Article 15 of the International Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights talks about the right to science and the right to culture. And I've spent a good deal of time thinking about why those are both in the same article. And how do we go about creating a common understanding? I mean, as Marco pointed out, you can say you should do this or you shouldn't do this other thing, and people are going to go and do whatever they want. I mean, we have the example of the Chinese scientist who went off and you know, we ended up with twins, right? Genetically modified twins. So for a outside body or for one group to simply say, well, we've decided what this is and you're doing really well and you're not doing so well and because we've decided that, isn't actually going to, in my view, now I'm just talking about my personal view on this based on having thought about it and talked with people over this over time, that's actually not going to create the kind of change that we need. That we've actually got to create a social movement. We've got to create a consensus and a set of ideas about what the right to science means and what it would look like to implement it. And so working this process through where there's, through the UN process, where there is at least some legitimacy, and that this is going to happen gradually over time. I think it's extremely important that Marco's organization is doing what he's doing in terms of pushing within the courts. I think that the directions that we were talking about in terms of working with national academies, if national academies start actually engaging in projects and shared products, shared projects and making statements about this, then we're going to start shifting that culture and we can start actually making this happen because there's no outside group that can make it happen. And simply us saying, any us, meaning any particular single organization, it's not actually going to achieve what we would like it to achieve. And so for that reason, we just have to go through the social processes to create that culture change. That's my view.
Yeah, can I just say, I think, I mean, it's a new idea, especially for the academy. So you saw in our survey, most of them actually had never heard of this. So, I mean, I think just having this conversation now, building on what Margaret said, like kind of starts to get people thinking. But yeah, I don't think this would be the right organizational structure to do something like you're saying. But just by framing their activities with this lens, if they chose to do that, would be a huge step in sort of shifting the conversation. Academies are quite conservative for a variety of reasons, that, you know, like it's kind of central to what they need to do. So, but I mean, one thing is just as an entry to the human rights, so I would say academies have been fairly comfortable in terms of defending the academic freedom of their colleagues. So for example, scientists that have been attacked wrongly by their governments in academic, so they will, you know, support and try to defend. And so this is sort of like one entry point for academies that in a human rights context they sort of are comfortable working in, and then maybe like talking more about it helps them think about how their other work might be informed by this.
If you go to freedomofresearch.org and you look at this section that's called Shadow Report, you can become a secular evangelist because you can also prepare your own country report or shadow report along the lines of what you can find there. We also have a monitoring system that pulls together I think if, again, institutions may take a little longer to come close to the idea, individuals can certainly start a revolution, I would say, but within the system, so that if you raise a question, why don't we organize a panel discussion about the right to science next time you have a public meeting, and then perhaps little by little things can start.
Clearly this is closer to the beginning of a conversation than it is to the end. Thank you for coming, and please join me in thanking the panelists.